You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Lacrosse Boots. So here's what Lacrosse has recently done. They've taken their 100 plus years of experience to create a new line of lace-up hunting boots called the Navigator Series. Now, the Navigator Series comes in two options, the Atlas for men and the Windrose for both men and women. Now, if you want to find out more about their high-quality awesome boots, you need to go to lacrossefootwear.com.
Welcome to the Southern Ground Hunting Podcast. I'm your host, Parker McDonald, and this is episode number 43. Today, we are officially capping off the Local Legends Summer Series. I'm sitting down with my friend Drew Robbins and Ted Bright, and we're breaking down key points from each of our Local Legends guests. Get ready. This is the Southern Ground Hunting Podcast. Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Southern Ground Hunting Podcast. I am saddened today because today is the absolute cap of the Local Legends series. It's going to be a great episode, and I've got my buddies Drew Robbins and Ted Bright. They're going to be talking with me. What we're doing in this episode is we're breaking down key points that each of our Local Legends brought to the table in their episode. That's Warren Womack, Jamie McKay, Peter Updike, and Rick Kiley, who you heard from last week. It's a great episode, so full of information. I'm really excited, though, today because, of course, Drew, you heard from him a couple weeks ago. Drew Robbins, great guy. Just an absolute blast getting to hang out with him and talk with him. But this is the first time we've had Ted Bright on the show, and I've talked to Ted several times about coming on. But it's been one of those conflicts in my mind of having him on as a guest because he's not necessarily a Southerner, which some people might consider Missouri to be a Southern state. I don't really know. So if you know for sure that Missouri is considered a Southern state, let me know. But Ted is so full of information. The guy's a big buck killer. He's a diehard saddle hunter. And we had a guy from New York on last week. So, you know, what's the big deal about having somebody on from Missouri? It's all good. I'm super glad Ted was able to come on the show. We were able to work this thing out. And, stay tuned. If you love talking about whitetail deer, if you like breaking down tactics and strategies, this is a great episode for it. Before we get into that, I want to let you guys know that if you're not using Onyx Maps, you need to start soon, especially if you're a public land hunter. Can't tell you how many times Onyx has saved my life. So go to onyxmaps.com, get your membership, and just make your hunting altogether easier. Speaking of making your hunting easier, let's talk about tetherednation.com for a minute. I'm super jacked about this season. This is going to be my second season in a saddle. And my first, last year I was in a saddle at the beginning of the Alabama season. And Kentucky season, though, when we went for the opener in Kentucky, I did not have my saddle yet, and it made everything much more difficult. The trees are harder to climb. They're not tall, straight trees like we have here in Alabama. So I was using a climber. Just wasn't my cup of tea. It was really tough. I'm not going to say that's why I didn't kill a deer, but I will say if I could have been in the trees that I wanted to be in, then it would have been a lot easier to get a shot off. I'm really excited about using my Mantis saddle and Predator platform in Kentucky this year. Speaking of saddle hunting, big announcement. In 2 days from the time this episode airs, that's going to be August the 24th, Saturday, we're doing the Alabama Saddle Hunter Demo Day. And it's going to be a blast. I've got a lot of guys that are going to be there. So many people have told me they're coming. We're going to have saddle people with all different kinds of saddles there, and just trying out their methods, their climbing methods. It's going to be a great time. We're going to provide lunch for you, so it's 100% free, and lunch is going to be provided. Just want to have a great time, and we're going to shoot our bows, practice a little bit doing that, and just all together going to be a great time. So if you're in the area or you want to make the drive to Odenville, Alabama, we're doing that. I believe it's at 10 o'clock in the morning on Saturday morning before it gets hopefully too terribly warm. We're going to go from about 10 to 2 and eat lunch in between. Just hang out and have a good time with like-minded people. So that's going to be a blast, guys. I'm so excited again about this episode. We're going to go ahead and get into this. This is the, what will we call it? We'll call it the Local Legends Breakdown Podcast with my buddies Drew Robbins and Ted Bright. Hope you guys like it. All right, guys, welcome back to the Southern Ground Hunting Podcast. I'm joined here with my buddy Drew. How's it going, Drew?
Good, man. How are you, Parker?
I'm good. And also, all the way in Missouri, our friend Ted Bright. Ted, what's going on, bud?
Howdy, howdy, fellas. Thanks for having me on this morning, Parker.
Yeah, man, absolutely. So here's the deal. Here's what we're going to do today. We're going to break down all of the local legends.
Yeah.
And what we're going to do is we're going to just talk about several things that we feel like were important to each of those episodes and each of those guests. Several of the key things that maybe make them successful or make them worthy of being called a local legend. I think that's a legendary is kind of a word. It's like the word game changer. You know, they kind of get thrown around there a lot. And so doing this episode that kind of that those guests are not going to be able to defend for themselves on this episode, or they probably wouldn't even be defending for themselves. What they would be doing is saying, oh man, that's not me. Stop talking about me. You know, that's just how these guys are. So, but before we do that, I want our listeners to get to hear from Ted a little bit. They got to hear from you, Drew.
Yeah.
What was it?
A couple weeks ago.
And they have not ever gotten to hear from Ted. Now, Ted is, obviously he's in Missouri, so it's not really, Ted, would you consider that a Midwest state, or is it kind of like, I don't know, is it sort of Southern?
It's a Midwest state with a remnants of a Southern theme. How's that?
Okay. Nice. I like that.
Yeah.
It sounds Midwest, though. The way that you said that was a really Midwest thing to say. Southern people would have said, oh, well, I reckon it's pretty Southern. It's kind of in the Midwest on the map, but that would have been how a Southern person would have explained it, Ted. So
I reckon it's Southern from way back. Huh?
There it is. There it is.
Reckon. All right. So, Ted, obviously you are a deer hunter because we wouldn't have you on this podcast. Why don't you talk a little bit, let our listeners know kind of your style of hunting and kind of how you navigate the woods. And man, I know the last couple of years you've been pretty successful doing it. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, thank you. Well, again, thanks for having me on the show this morning. It's going to be a good time discussing the greatest of the local legend series that you did, which was excellent.
Greatest hits.
So a little bit of
that's what we should call it.
I'm sorry?
The greatest hits of the local legend series. That's what it'll be.
There you go. So a little bit of history on me. I grew up in Pennsylvania, hunting the, you know, south central eastern area in Maryland, in the mountains also. So that's where I kind of cut my teeth, especially on archery hunting. And then at the age of 16, I moved to Missouri and, you know, always been a big public land guy. I've, you know, killed my first deer on public land. I killed my first deer with a bow on public land. I killed my first buck with a bow on public land. So, you know, rich history of public land hunting. Then I actually kind of got away from it for a while and hunted primarily on private land. And then, you know, as my hunting has evolved, I've also become very passionate about youth hunting. So, you know, I've taken two kids through the youth career hunting, and, you know, it's been a tremendous amount of fun and success, and you know, or my kids, they kind of take after me, and they like to do it the right way. You know, they're not afraid to go in deep. You know, my son and I will do a lot of you know, weekend camping trips on public land, and those have turned out to be, you know, extremely successful as well.
Yeah.
And I'll be embarking upon that again with my youngest, who's now five, and she is ready to go. She is her flame is lit, and she is excited for hunting.
Great.
Yeah, she was actually with me last year when I killed a nice 10-pointer, and, you know, I don't hardly rifle hunt anymore at all, but I did, you know, to take her out with me, you know, and sure enough, we ended up killing a 10-pointer behind the house. It was pretty cool.
That's cool. Good, I remember seeing a picture of that. That's, man, I'll tell you what, that's how I got started. Like, that's how I got hooked, was just being there with my dad. I didn't even care if he was shooting it or me. Like, I was 7 years old, and I was like, man, this is so cool. I talked about it, I think, in one episode pretty recently, but like, it's kids likes, this is going to sound maybe a little bit morbid, but pretty true. Like, I've never seen a little boy that saw a dead deer and then said, "Ooh, gross." You know, they're always like, "Oh, that's so cool." You know? And it's just, or a dead turkey or a fish, skinning fish. There's just something ingrained in us that, especially at a young age, that's like, that's not gross. That is natural, and that's cool.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting. And if you can navigate that the way that you're doing it, Ted, and really harness that, man, it can pay off big time.
Definitely. You know, I think there's a lot to be said for being self-sufficient, right? Mm-hmm. Being able to do things on your own, not rely on others. And I think that, you know, in today's society, it's a little shameful, but there's a lot of kids that grow up thinking that their food comes from the grocery store or, you know, wherever their parents are shopping for it, instead of, you know, what's more natural, and that is providing for it for yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, man, my family is like, my mom, I'm not going to say she didn't like deer meat. She did like deer meat, but it took a while for her to like it. But then we kind of got to a point where it was like, just like normal, that's what we ate, was if we had anything that was quote unquote beef, we would replace that with venison. Cause it's what
good.
We had. And,
yeah.
And I say it was free, but it was really mostly expensive, but it kind of got to where now, you know, because that was instilled into me at a young age. Now when I'm like, one of my favorite parts about the hunt is going to the processor, and that's kind of like where everything comes back full circle. So it's like this is the last part of this hunt experience of this specific deer, is when I go to the processor, or if I do all the processing myself, when that's finished and it's all bagged up, it's like, that is what completes it for me. And man, I think it's just so cool. Like, that's something I learned at a young age, and most people learned at a young age. And when you keep those values, you know, I would go so far as to say people who are poachers right now probably were instilled the values of poachers as kids. You know what I mean? And so we really have the opportunity to do that. And that's kind of, we talked about this before, but that's kind of the overarching theme of the Local Legends series, is getting other people involved is kind of the, not being selfish.
Yeah.
Would kind of be the normal thing, but we'll get into that here in just a minute. Drew, I'm going to give you a chance to tell us what you've been up to for the past 2 weeks since you've been on the show.
Well, I was doing really good getting out and shooting my bow, getting everything ready for the deer season. And then we've had a busy couple of weeks there at the house.
Yeah.
So I haven't done much shooting and much prepping, but have been in the saddle some more. My Versa straps came in. And so, and Ted, this will be my first year saddle hunting. And so I don't know if you listened to the episode a couple weeks ago, but I went all out, man. I sold every stand that I had. And and so I'm going all out saddle hunting this year. So I'm just getting used to it, getting adjusted to it. And I put my MicroFit adjusters on. Man, those things are awesome.
Yeah. I don't even use mine.
Yeah. But I'm a little bit bigger than you are.
Yeah.
And
true.
So I've just been getting, I guess, Greg would call it saddle shape, you know, just sitting, just getting used to it. And man, I'm loving it.
That's cool.
Loving it.
That's awesome.
I'm glad you said that because that was, I know Ted was probably about to get into that part of his whole process of how he does things and his style of hunting.
Ted, I have watched your videos. I've creeped you on YouTube. So just to let you know, I've watched some stuff. And so, because I'm just trying to learn, you know, just trying to learn. And so, but man, I love that thing. It's awesome.
Well, welcome to the saddle hunting ranks.
I appreciate it, man. I appreciate it. So I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked Parker. If you could give one piece of advice to a brand new saddle hunter, what would it be?
You've already done it. You sold all your stands. You're fully committed. That's it. Seriously.
Yes.
Just go,
you know, your
go
first
all
two
in.
Times up there, it's going to be, it's going to be a little uncomfortable. You're going to be fiddling with it, you know. And then your first couple times of hunting, you're going to be like, this is so cool. And next thing you know, you're going to be swinging around like a damn monkey and you're going to you're going to have does that run off or even a buck, whatever. Because this happens to everybody.
Right.
But as you evolve throughout your first season of hunting in a saddle, you start to figure it all out. You know, you start to really incorporate the strategy into it, not just swinging around like a monkey because it's cool. And I promise you that will happen. You're fully committed, you know. That is my single biggest piece of advice to everybody that's considering getting into saddle hunting, because if you had to do it, you would do it. And you have a learning curve when you were 12 years old and you started hunting out of a tree stand or, you know, whatever that age was, you're going to have that learning curve. So you might as well just go all in. You know, there's enough people out there that are saying this is a superior way to hunt that, you know, it should be resonating with people. So you've done it the right way, and I would venture to say that you'll have a very successful first season.
Well, I appreciate it, man, and thank you for putting some good content out there. And also what I love most about it, too, is that even your son, you know, is into the saddle game, and it just shows the safety of the saddle, you know, and which is just really cool to see.
Yeah, it builds up your confidence in the system a lot more. I'm pretty pumped about that. So Ted, tell us when did you start saddle hunting?
I have saddle hunted for two full seasons. Okay. And to your point, Drew, being up in a tree in a saddle with my son right below me in a saddle and watching him shoot a nice 2.5-year-old 8-point buck on public ground last year on land that we'd never been to.
Oh,
was
man.
One of our crowning achievements of my hunting career, for sure. It was awesome.
I can't wait, man. Gosh, I can't wait.
He just actually woke up to get ready for school right now and walked out into the garage and was able to hear me say that on this podcast. So that's pretty cool.
That's cool.
That's cool.
Is he still in there?
Yes, he is.
What's up, TJ?
Here, let me put you on speakerphone real quick.
Okay.
Of course, he's a groggy 16-year-old. But
sure, that's okay.
I mean, that's just a given.
All right.
What's up, TJ? You're on the podcast right now. You doing all right?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Doing good, dude. How's football going?
Good. It's a big change, but
what's the change? What's the change about it right now?
Bigger school, different playbook.
Nice.
A lot better athletes on our team and other teams.
Yeah. So are you, what position are you playing this year? Just for all the listeners.
Quarterback.
Man, got all the ladies running after you, don't you? Golly.
Oh, of course.
us linemen, we didn't really get that. We got more.
No.
We were too busy at the vending machine, but whatever. All right, TJ, man, have a great day at school. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, see you, bud.
See ya.
You back, Ted?
Yep, I'm back.
Dude, okay, I have a question for you, all right? How do you balance, because me and my dad probably didn't do this very well, how do you balance football and deer hunting with your kid?
Well, it's tough because the two just, you know, coincide. from the season's perspective. You just got to make it work, you know. I mean, from TJ's third grade through eighth grade years, I was his coach, you know, and we practiced three nights a week, you know. So not only does that take three nights of hunting out of the equation, but then, you know, what are you going to go hunting the other two nights and not be home at all? So it definitely makes it tough. Just got to get in as much, you know, weekend hunting as you can. And now that he's in high school, you know, he's going into his junior year. That has definitely freed up time for me. But, you know, he is really relegated to weekend hunting during football. But football, you know, for his high school previous was ending, you know, as soon as, you know, with one playoff game, basically. So that was ending right around the end of October, early November. So, like, last year it worked out perfect. His first weekend of not having film study and game prep and all that stuff, we were able to go on that public land adventure that we went on where we both killed bucks and, you know, he killed that 8-pointer out of the same tree as me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you just kind of got to make it work. But, you know, November is largely free. But however, this year, you know, with a different school, he could be playing deep into November. So, you know, that might be a different paradigm even this year. But at the end of the day, you just take the opportunities when you can get them and make the most of them.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Ted, I have a question for you, and it's because this is all tying into the same theme of just getting hunters involved in everything. And I know you have – You had mentioned you have a 16-year-old boy, but you also have a 5-year-old girl. And do you see a difference in you know, and this isn't guys versus girls, but in introducing your son to hunting and then introing your girls into hunting?
Yeah, well, I shouldn't say that. It's more a personality thing. So I have a 19-year-old daughter also, and she, you know, she's killed several deer. She enjoys going once, twice, three times a year. She gets so worked up when she sees deer. I could tell stories that's like, oh my gosh. And we, you know, when we're sitting around the family table at holidays or whatever, you know, these are always the stories that come up because it's always an adventure. But she's not the type that, you know, wants to go all the time. And when we do go, she hunts really hard. She's one of the quietest walkers in the woods I've ever heard. Normally, you know, I'm, you know, like getting on to people because they don't walk quiet enough for me. But she does. And it's interesting, you know, that it's her. Now my 5-year-old, she is just like TJ. She is just all into it. I mean, she wants to go scouting. She wants to go walk in the woods. She, you know, at the age of 5, just 2 weeks ago, we went out and hung a game camera and we had to walk through, you know, some of the real thick scrub brush and everything. And she's like, "Daddy, just go ahead. I'll keep up with you. I'll keep up with you. Don't worry about me." And that was how TJ was. So I see it as not necessarily as much of a male versus female as a personality thing. And there's a lot of other aspects where her personality is very similar to TJ's as well.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Because I have a 5- and 3-year-old, a 5-year-old girl, and a 3-year-old boy, and I know Parker has two kids, and so just introducing them, I was able to take baby girl twice last year, and we went, you know, setting the ground blind, and she just ate it up. I mean, just, you know, taking the binoculars and looking at them out the wrong way, you know, and she's like, "Daddy, I can see a deer," and there's no deer there, you know, and so it was so much fun, man, so much fun.
I see one. Well, all right. So we kind of really need to get started on this episode. So basically what we're doing, I'll say it again, what we're doing is we're going to break down the Local Legends series, all of our guests, kind of the key points that each guest talked about. And I'm super excited about this. I've really enjoyed the series. Everybody who's listening, guys, thank you so much for your feedback on it. It has been nothing short of incredible. It's been so awesome. And I think we're going to be able to do this again maybe next summer and talk to some other people. But we're going to just kind of go around the room / phone and just kind of talk about this. So I'll start with Warren Woolmix. And I'll start knowing that Drew, your what you're going to talk about is going to probably be what we end up talking about the most, because I think it's really good. But one of the things that really stuck out for me from Warren Womack was the segment about him talking about how he trains every single, like around September is when he starts getting into shape. He climbs a tree. He started this tradition. And when I think back to this episode, something that I can apply to what I have applied even more this year, something I could apply to what I do to make me a better deer hunter, it's going to be that one.
Yeah.
It's to make it a tradition, not just something that I do kind of, but do it, you know, if it's first thing in the morning, go out and climb a tree, get practice at it, get fluent at it. It's just going to make you better. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, there was that was such a good episode. There was so much. I mean, you almost didn't want to take notes on it because you just wanted to hear him talk, you know? And so, because it was just awesome. But one of the things that I did write down was he was talking about those primary feed trees. What do you do when you don't find that primary feed tree? Mm-hmm. You know, and then obviously his journal was just phenomenal. I mean, just absolutely great. But Ted, what were your thoughts on some of Warren's?
Gosh, I would say anybody that wants to, you know, further their hunting acumen, anybody that is maybe hit a rut and they're looking for inspiration, or anybody that's looking to get into hunting should listen to that podcast. It's one of the best I've heard in a long time. And quite frankly, Parker, it really didn't have a whole lot to do with your hosting abilities. It was all okay. Mr. Warren.
Listen, I understand.
I'm kidding.
I understand.
I'm kidding. But seriously. He does make it easy because, man, is he a wealth of knowledge.
He is.
He is inspirational. You know, just seeing his posts on the various social media outlets and everything, the guy is amazing. You know, I mean, he's the guy that you want to pattern your life after. He's so methodical. But he enjoys it. He's passionate about it. You know, it's not robotic. I mean, you know, that's kind of the overarching theme that I took away from it. I guess it just more hammered it home than what I knew from posts and other podcasts. But that was the most personal that I had heard from him. And it's, you know, I'm going to listen to it probably a couple more times just because it was that good. But at 77 years old, you know, I mean, he's out there practicing, like you said, Parker, weeks before the season. So, you know, before he got into a saddle 3 years ago. Oh, yeah, by the way, that's a great point. At 74 years old, he decides to embark upon this newfangled hunting craze called saddle hunting at 74. You know, I mean, that's a great testament right there. But before that, when he incorporated a rock harness climbing system into his you know, his safety regimen and his lock on, he would go out and practice escape or rescuing whatever it is from a fallen position. And if that's not methodic, you know, then what is? He's out in his tree in his yard. I can picture it at 74 years old, basically simulating a scenario where he has fallen and his rock harness has caught him. And, you know, how do I get out now? You know, that's I don't crazy. Know. I just find that next level that most guys are not willing to do.
No, not at all.
No. He's building his own stands. He's mocking up his own stands during the lunch break.
Yeah.
Taking them to a welder and be like, can you make – I mean, he's just next level on everything.
Yeah, he is. He is. I enjoy Warren because he, especially on social media, Warren's kind of created this maybe he more or less brought it back to a world that is mostly concerned with bigger deer and antler size and things like that. And did you kill that on public or private? Or did you shoot that with a bow or did you shoot that with a gun? Well, Warren kind of does all of it and does all of it extremely well. So whenever he posts a picture of a little basket rack 5-point or something on Instagram, it may have a traditional, may have like a recurve bow next to it. It may have a rifle laying next to it. It may have a compound bow laying next to it. doesn't really matter. And I think Warren's kind of shed a light on the fact that it's all hunting, and mm-hmm. you can do all of it or not. You can do one of those things. It doesn't really matter. Neither one of them is better or worse. It's just all about the preference. If you like to bow hunt with a recurve bow better, then by golly, do it. But if you want to use a gun, do that too. Nobody's sitting here. Nobody's going to say, I say nobody's going to say anything. People will say things, but they shouldn't.
Yeah.
And I think you're going to see, an influx of that as Warren and people like Warren gain more popularity, and as social media gets bigger and, you know, people like that start to pop up. I think you're going to see that. But I do want to talk about what you talked about, Drew, and I really want to break this down and try to break it down as good as I can. Okay. on primary feed trees.
Okay.
Let me ask you this, Ted, is this something that you do as well there in Missouri? Is that finding those primary feed trees?
Yeah, you know, there's definitely some of that. But you know, there's so many oak trees in Missouri that, you know, when we talk about primary food trees in Missouri, we're largely talking about, especially October, November timeframe, or even September, you're talking about, you know, acorns. And, mm-hmm. you know, I know he delineates between hard mass and soft mass, and, you know, you'll have some of that here, you know, maybe some deer eating maple leaves and such, but primarily you're talking about oak trees. And I can't do it to the level that Warren can, but, you know, finding that acorn tree that is the most palatable to them at that period of time is pretty tough to do when the majority of the forest is those oak trees, you know, that are producing the acorns.
Yeah.
I can't say that I can do it to the level of Warren, that's for sure, although I am trying.
Yeah.
So I know that doesn't really answer your question, but...
No, it does. It does answer it, because I would say mostly the same thing for mm-hmm. me in Alabama. I have one specific spot that I hunt that is, I mean, it's just all white oaks. That's all it is in this whole area. So you know the deer are going to be around there somewhere, mm-hmm. but you don't exactly know. It takes you a while to pinpoint the exact trail that they're going to take or the exact tree that they're going to be feeding under. And I say that to say this, when I was in Kentucky last year on my second trip to Kentucky, it was not like that. There wasn't nearly the amount of white oaks that we, at least not in the areas I was in, that we have out here. And I remember one day, it was in October, early October, so the acorns were starting to fall, and the trees that were really starting to produce were getting hit really hard. And so I remember one day it was an evening hunt, and I was sitting on a cornfield, like right inside the woods. Not, I wouldn't say it was a field edge, because I was hunting the woods as well.
Yeah.
But I could see just a couple little windows of this cornfield. And all of a sudden, man, I just start seeing deer just popping out of these woods. So I get to looking at my map. I'm like, it looks like they're popping out right here. And I could access, I was kayak accessing right there, but I could actually access where those deer were coming out at by the road probably a little bit easier, because it was giant, big, huge ag field right there. And so I got to looking at the map, and I was like, okay, that looks like it. The next morning I hiked in there and went to where I thought they were popping out at. It ended up not being right there, but when I was walking out that morning, I came across this primary feed tree. And that is exactly the spot where those deer were staged up before they popped into that field.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like it all just clicked. Yeah. And so, you know, those primary feed trees, what I've seen with those, obviously you have in that situation, you have the cornfield. So their majority of their time is going to be spent in that cornfield. But dude, it looked like hogs had just come through there and plowed it over. Every leaf was chomped up and all that. And that was the first time I really ever had I haven't hunted feed trees, you know, mm-hmm. but this was like, I guess maybe you put the primary on that. This was the primary feed tree
See,
in the area.
We or at least I
did. And you could see the clear line of delineation between the outer circle of that tree and, as Mr. Womack referred to it, the radius of the drip line. Huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
He had perfect terminology for everything because he has a systematic approach to everything,
yep.
which a lot of successful people have in no matter what, in whatever regard their passion is or their success is.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's like, you know, so many of us are always just like working really hard to try to figure out, well, okay, what's my next step in getting here, or whatever. And it's really easy to get away from the things that have worked for you in the past. And that's why I like Mr. Womack in this episode, because he doesn't – like, he may change some things, like he changed – got into the saddle, and he may change some spots, some things. But at the end of the day – and his journal probably has a lot to do with that, because what he ends up doing is going back and having a place where he can just reflect and look at without – again, without using any brain power. He has it written down, so he's not having to – just try to remember everything, but he has a place where he can look at and see all of the common denominators with all of these encounters, with all of these kills, from the day that it was on. And it just, what you're talking about, Ted, about it being a systematic approach, it's a system that he can go back and look and prove that it worked.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, to your point on that, on his documentation of those kills, you know, this is maybe one of the underlooked things of or aspects of the podcast that I took away, is that, you know, he knew the exact, not only the exact number, but he knew the, you know, a short story associated with that and could recollect that easily. Mm-hmm. Not to mention the fact that at 77 years old, he's incorporating a computer and now a phone into that. So that's really cool also.
Right.
Yeah.
But the fact that he knows exactly how many deer he kills. Now think about that. A lot of people, especially when that number is, I think it was 385. Is that right?
It's over 350.
Yeah.
I know that.
So a lot of people would be turned off by that. A lot of people would think of that hunter, you know, especially if they didn't know who it was or they didn't know Warren, would think that that's, you know, that's like a blood sport, or, you know, that's a, I don't know, keeping stats like that, I think that there's this negative connotation out there. And, you know, I probably have shied away from doing stuff like that in the past for that reason. But the meaning that he has behind it is far greater than just a number of kills or the quantity of deer that he's killed. It had meaning to it. It had substance to it. So it's kind of opened my eyes to that. And, you know, I talked to a couple other people recently that have done similar things. And I've encouraged my son to do that now, because I wouldn't be able to possibly recollect all the deer that I've killed. But I've encouraged my son to do that. And he's at 16 deer now. And he started, you know, he has a little short story written about each one of them. So, you know, we've kind of taken a page from that. And I think that that's really cool. It's not, you know, just a meaningless stat of how many deer have you killed. There's a meaning behind it. Yeah. There's substance behind it. And I find that pretty powerful.
Yeah, that's cool. All right. So I think that's I think we're good. Does anybody have any last final words on Mr. Womack?
I just want to listen again.
You just want to listen to it again? Yep. I probably will listen to it again now that we've been talking about it. All right. So let's move on to Jamie McKay. And Jamie was our guest. This was a hard thing for me, because there was a lot of good people that I could have talked to from Alabama, because I know a lot of people from Alabama, and I know a lot of people who are good deer hunters in Alabama. But I really kind of wanted to spread it out a little bit more and not just talk to people from Alabama. But Jamie was the one that people kept bringing him up to me, like, man, have you met Jamie McKay? Have you ever met Jamie McKay? Jamie McKay he's the real deal. You should probably talk to Jamie McKay, get him on the podcast. And you know, one of the other funny thing, Ted, you may not understand this because you're from Missouri and you may not have nearly the amount of Southern accents that we have down here, but anytime somebody tells me that, oh, so-and-so's, they kill big deer on Bankhead, I just get this mental image of what the person probably talks like and how they sound, and it, like, it may not translate well on a podcast. And so somebody told me about Jamie McKay, and I was like, okay, yeah, I'll talk to him. And I called him up on the phone, and this guy was impressive from the get-go. He's well-spoken. He's Southern as they get, but he's a very well-spoken guy. He's super kind, and he's very smart and super successful.
Mm-hmm.
This guy has got, I mean, like, I think it was 31 skull caps mm-hmm. that are up in that room that are all impressive. Like,
yeah,
I'm not talking about like, oh, it's just a dink here and there. These are deer that a lot of people would have shoulder mounted. And I walked into that room and I was like, oh, that's cool. Yeah, that's really neat. And then we went inside his house and he was like, here's where the big boys are at. And I was like, holy crap. He's just got just a wall full of things. So that full of deer that are just super impressive. So let's start backwards. We'll start with you, Ted. Let's talk about Jamie McKay. What's something that stuck out to you?
Okay. So I would say, you know, with the number 31 stuck out in my mind also. And, you know, the 31 skull caps that you referenced. One of the things that I liked about that, though, is, well, for one thing, he welcomed you into his home. So that really says a lot right there.
Yeah.
And it makes, I would have to say it probably makes for a better podcast, you know, when you're in person. So
it does.
That's always good. You know, I like to see that and hear that. But to me, you know, the conversation after the 31 skullcaps were referenced went to the score of those deer. And I think the range was like from the 130s to 162 or something like that. But mm-hmm. You can tell by the way somebody talks about that, what does it mean to them? Because, you know, scoring can be a mechanism for, understanding how mature that deer was, or, you know, how, at the end of the day, it just matters how big is the trophy to the, right. To the hunter. And I could tell that is what resonated with Jamie. It wasn't, oh, I killed a 162 and it was 10 inches bigger than my buddy's, you know?
Yeah.
It was just a frame of reference for a guy that enjoys killing deer the right way on public mm-hmm. land, where a lot of others have not had that success. So, you know, I thought that was pretty cool. The recurring theme of getting others involved in hunting, and, you know, the story of him and his daughter dragging out that 8-point buck, and, you know, she got blisters, but she wants to go back to that same spot this year. That always resonates with me.
Yeah. That was that whole segment about him talking about his daughter and taking her out, and then he ended up sending me after, I think it was after the podcast, he ended up sending me a picture of the daughter that killed the 8-point on, I think it was an 8-point,
yeah,
on public land. Just the whole story was just just absolutely incredible. I really enjoyed that. And I'm gonna make it a little bit awkward here, right here, Ted, because I just read your message that you sent me about Jamie not killing a deer over a scrape.
Calling me out, huh?
No. To
make sure I got that in.
No, yeah, I think it's really interesting. And talk about that, Ted, from your perspective. Is that something in Missouri that would be probably pretty rare? Is it kind of a normal thing to hunt over scrapes?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that when you get into, you know, that pre-rut time frame of, mid-October to, you know, for basically the last 2 weeks of October and, you know, into November, you know, a lot of times you're going to be focusing on, a scrape close to bedding.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty common tactic around here, you know, especially when targeting a specific buck or a specific buck bedding area. But yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting that he said that he has spent countless hours sitting over, you know, what I sure he was referring to as destination scrapes, and, you know, close to bedding. And I don't know exactly if he said that he's never seen a buck come to it, but something along those lines, a lot of hours and very few encounters. And I found that pretty interesting. Yeah.
So Ted, let me ask you just to be clear, it's not just a scrape that you're hunting. It's a scrape close to bedding that you're, so proximity matters. That is what you're saying, correct?
Absolutely, because the majority of scrapes are made at night along field edges, or even in staging areas that you know, mature buck is not going to reach that area before it gets dark.
Right, and that's what we see a lot down here is on the edge of a, you know, clear cut green field, you know, something like that. We will see those, and then, you know, guys set up over those, and they're like, I've set up here for the last 4 weeks and I haven't seen nothing. And it's like, well, yeah, because 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, that's when it's being made. Mm-hmm. But you're saying the proximity to bedding is what makes you hunt that scrape.
Absolutely. Yeah. That buck is going, you know, if he's a mature dominant buck, he's going to want to get up and mark his territory.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and earlier in the year, he's going to want to get up and eat acorns. Mm-hmm. And of course we already talked about how, you know, how ubiquitous they are, and they can kind of almost meander off in any direction.
Right.
But when you get into that late October timeframe, I find that, you know, that mature buck is going to want to get up and mark his territory.
Yeah.
Whether that be through a rub or a scrape, but he's typically going to want to find his way to, you know, one of those primary scrapes on the edges of his bedding, and get, you know, get there pretty quick. And it's typically going to be within daylight or right at, you know, that last shooting minute.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard this. This was on a Hunting Beast podcast episode, probably the most recent one that they've done. And it was with Andre DeQuisto. And he talks about pecking order licking branches, and basically those early season quote unquote scrapes that people think are would be considered scrapes because the ground is, you know,
tore up,
bare, it's down to the dirt where they're at. But what it really is the bucks just establishing pecking order on that licking branch, and they stand in that same spot so many times that it just eventually wears down the grass. Because so many bucks are trying to establish where they fall in the pecking order, and that is where you would hunt in that early season if you're going to hunt a scrape. I don't hunt scrapes. That would be the closest thing I would ever do to if I see something open up like around the beginning of October or so, or something that looks like a scrape. What I'm going to assume is that's a pecking order. Ted, and the reason I say that early October is because that's our early season, our rut. Out here is like December, so it's like later in December, some places in January, so it would actually be probably closer to what for you guys where you're at, what you would experience around September, your kind of early season stuff. But for us in October, that scrape, it may not be a scrape. And actually somebody a guy was listening to the podcast that hunts where we hunt, and he sent me a video of a buck that he had been watching for a couple of years, a good deer. I mean, a really good buck, and it's a video trail camera.
Nice.
And I'm looking at it, and I'm like, man, that's a good buck. It looks like a solid deer. And I noticed that the leaves are green behind it, and so it wasn't late in the season. Leaves hadn't dropped yet.
Yeah.
Everything was still green.
Yeah.
But this buck is on a scrape where he's licking a branch, and later in the video, it's only about a 20-second video or something, I messaged the guy. I said, hey, quick question. Did that buck ever actually paw at the ground? And he was like, no, he didn't. He never pawed at the ground. And I was like, that is where I would hunt. That's the type of quote-unquote scrape, which is not,
right,
that I would hunt. And it kind of proves that theory that Andre was talking about, that these aren't necessarily scrapes. It doesn't mean they won't turn into scrapes eventually. Once they start opening up scrapes, but they're not necessarily always going to be scrapes. It might just be worn out dirt.
It's true.
Which is pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. That's the only time here in the South, and because I agree with Jamie, that's the only time here in the South that I would ever hunt a scrape just because there's a scrape there. Now, I may hunt a terrain feature that has a scrape close by.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to be hunting there specifically because I see a scrape. I'm going to be hunting there for something else. Because once they start opening up, I mean, again, most of the sign that I see is made at night.
Yeah.
I just don't see it. I don't see bucks working scrapes unless they're close to bedding like Ted is talking about. And really only in that early part of the season. I just don't see bucks hit scrapes.
No, much. I don't either.
I
think that they use licking branches year round, right? Mm-hmm. And not until, you know, the buildup of testosterone do they start to scrape, right? So
right.
The testosterone is what wants to, you know, makes them instinctively mark their territory. And, you know, around here, so in Missouri, you know, in the early October timeframe, you'll see young bucks who don't know how to handle that testosterone, just like when we were teenagers, right?
Mm-hmm.
We acted all young and dumb and out there marking our territory as much as we possibly could, right?
Yeah.
So the young bucks start making their scrapes then, you know, and they take it to another level and they're just not using the licking branches. But I mean, I agree with the pecking order all year long is displayed in the licking branches. And then when the bucks of that age, you know, that testosterone gets to be at a significant point, then they start, you know, using those scrapes. And, you know, that's the same reason that, you know, they start to smell it. After, you know, you kill a mature buck during the early season, they don't stink. You kill a big buck in the second week in November, they smell like piss and tarsal glands. And, you know, I mean, it's, mm-hmm. you know, they pee right down their leg, right through their tarsal gland. And, you know, that's one of the things I always look for is that dark staining of the tarsal gland down the leg from them peeing down their leg into the scrape.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, man, that's just a lot of really good information right there on Jamie's episode. If you haven't listened to that one, guys, go ahead and check that one out, especially if you're a Southern hunter. That one really is catered to the Southern deer hunter. But we're going to move on fairly quickly, Ted. I know you got things you got to do and places you got to be at, so I want to be able to respect that as much as we can. So let's move on to who is next? Peter Updike.
Peter Updike.
Drew, why don't you start us out on Peter?
Well, man, his really was just it wasn't a tactical based, you know, podcast, which I liked because it was something different.
Mm-hmm.
But just the passion that he has for hunting, for public land, for introducing people, which once again there's that theme again of introducing people, kids, hunters to this great sport that we love, and you can tell just by the way that he talks. He loves hunting, and he loves hunting public land.
Yeah.
I mean, he just does. I mean, period. I mean, literally after the whole podcast was done, I was like, man, we should just put a period on this whole thing. Because it was like, he was so emphatic about it, you know?
Yeah.
It was really refreshing to hear.
I agree. He kind of set the stage for,
mm-hmm.
You know, it. Obviously he was the number three in the series.
Right.
But if he were number one, he would have been the person setting the stage,
yeah,
for all of the being influential, being more important than actually maybe even killing your buck.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
kill it. There's a lot of people who kill big deer. I mean, there's mm-hmm. a lot of people. Every time I get friend requests from people who it seems like they're just probably going to any deer hunter and sending them friend requests.
Yeah.
And I'll see I have 150 yeah. friend requests from. Or 150 yeah. mutual friends with this person. But these people, I never heard their name before, don't know anything about them, but they're in their profile picture with a giant buck.
Yeah.
Giant bucks is not what – giant bucks not is not what gets you known.
No, and I'm so glad that you pointed that out, Parker, because one of the things that also we – this theme or thread is each one of these guys is very humble.
Right.
Just very humble, you know. You don't see them out there bashing people on Facebook or any of the forums for, mm-hmm. Here's my 5 point. Well, Mr. Warren's got 67 5 points, you know?
Yeah.
Like no one's saying anything because of the type of man and character that he has. Mm-hmm. Just really humble. Just really humble.
Yeah. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I would say that would be the same for me with Peter. You know, I got to talk to the guy. He invited me to come out and hunt his areas. Invited, which is in Florida,
mm-hmm.
so and that's my number one goal this year, and probably until it happens, is to kill a legal deer in Florida. If I could do that, man, I'd feel like I was just, I'd feel like I was on top of the world.
Yeah.
So, how about you, Ted?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to have to echo those sentiments and say that, you know, his passion for the public land, you know, it was just so obvious that, you know, that I would say probably 9.5 out of 10 people would go, you know, would have the same takeaway from that podcast. And, you know, I love what he talked about, you know, the adventurous spirit of getting youth into know, cooking dinner over a campfire while you're out in the middle of nowhere, versus, you know, going to a movie or playing video games. And, you know, he said it himself. He said, you know, with his passion for adventure and utilizing our public lands, you know, he really laid down the gauntlet because he challenged each and every one of us. And he said, if you're not using it, then you're basically against it. Because that, you know, usage of that public land is what's going to keep that public land in our federal government's hands, not transferring it to the states, which is a huge issue that we're facing right now, because the federal government cannot sell off those lands, but our individual states can.
Right.
So, you know, his knowledge of that is excellent. I'm very appreciative for people like him that are out there spreading the word and, you know, for lack of a better term, lobbying on behalf of that. And, you know, so that was the most important takeaway for me. But I also just kind of anecdotally, I was really interested in the bear conversation in Florida. You know, I know that Florida has a heavy bear population, but I've never heard it in such a way that, you know, where hunters were that scared. And it was that much of a legitimate threat while you're in the woods. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm accustomed to that when I, you know, I go out to northwestern Montana. I've been up there several times in the same place in the Bob Marshall. And grizzlies are a legitimate threat. You know, I mean, it is front and center, you know, with every step through the woods. But I didn't realize it was that significant of a threat in Florida. It sounds like maybe the bears down there had been conditioned to the fact, you know, just like the grizzlies in Montana, that, you know, a hunter could potentially equal a dead deer, which equals food. So, you know, they've been classically trained like Pavlov's bear, right?
That was
interesting, to me as well. And kind of going back to your point about what Peter, you know, he talked about the one day that they did, they opened up a quota hunt for bears for like one day before it got, the quota got met. And he said, you know what? I have really no desire to kill a bear. He's like, if they opened it, I probably wouldn't hunt them cause I don't really care to. And he said, but I bought a tag anyways, cause I want to support our, you know, what our public lands are doing.
Yeah.
And going back to what you said, Ted, that is, That was an incredible thing to hear. You know, I'm trying to say this the right way. I'm not like that, right? Like I want to be. I want to be like that. I don't buy a duck stamp because I don't duck hunt.
Right.
Why would I buy a duck stamp? But what this episode did is it challenged me to just go ahead and do those things.
Yeah.
What's a couple dollars here and there that goes to a greater cause and a greater purpose to support something that I completely agree with. Another example is the at some of the boat ramps that I use on public land, I have to pay to use those boat ramps. It's like $45 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for a little while, and I'll just be honest, when I first, this was before I started the podcast or anything like that. This is a while back. For a little while, I would go in there and see if I could get away with not getting them to talk to me about, you know, like, it was like, it's $45 for a year, and then it's just a few dollars to do it during the, if you just do it every, you know, every day, if you do it just one day. But I got to a point where I had spent so much money, I didn't know there was a yearly fee. And so I had easily spent $45.
Yeah.
And then somebody told me, they're like, no, you can just get an annual pass. And I was like, well, bump this, man. I've just been putting money in this thing every single day. But what Peter did was he challenged me in those type of situations to realize that it's not just – they're not just taking your money because, you know, whatever, hashtag taxes or capitalism or whatever you want to say. That's not what they're doing at all. In fact, they're using that to build up and to and they're using your money to create a pool of money that they can use to, you know, keep our public lands there and pay the people who are taking care of the land. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so that episode for me was all about that, like being passionate about your public land. And on top of that, Peter kills big deer in Florida. So, I mean,
which is so hard to do.
Which is a hard. I mean, it's easy to overlook.
But it was almost
that.
Like a side note.
It was.
It
and
was.
That was what was so refreshing about it, is that he was just so.
Yeah.
He's like, if I don't ever kill another deer, it's fine. But I'm introducing people to it, and I'm also letting people know that we have great public lands out there. It was just a really good episode. It really was.
Yeah, I'm. Man, I was a fan. That's what I was. That's what I was kind of getting at. Is like, he kills big deer, but we weren't really talking about that.
Mm-mm.
We didn't really talk about that. And every time I would try to talk about it, Peter's like, oh, but listen to this. And we would kind of go off into another thing about why he's passionate about public land.
Yeah.
And so, like, I think one of the things I said, I was asking him about, like, how he picks an area. I was trying to make a little bit of tactical stuff in there. I'm talking about how do you pick an area? Are you doing in-season scouting or... you doing preseason scouting? Oh man, you know what? I just go out and enjoy the land.
Yeah,
that's what was his answer.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. I mean, that's that goes back to just being passionate about it. Just being passionate about public lands.
It was so good. And Ted, this referenced what you were saying earlier about you and TJ going out camping, getting up in the tree, shooting the buck. Like just the whole experience of what that is so much greater even than the kill. You know, I know the best memories for me growing up was when me and my dad went and did that. You know, wasn't about how big the buck was. Me and dad spent time in the outdoors, and it was just the whole experience of it. It was awesome. It was awesome.
Yeah, for sure. All right, let's move on to the most recent podcast and the last one in the series, other than this one, of course. And that was the first time.
Double lunger.
Yep. The first time I've had somebody on the show that is not Southern. And that is Rick Kiley. And that was for me, and I've been following Rick for a while. Rick was similar to like Warren Womack, where you've been following a person, you feel like you know him.
Yeah.
And when you finally get to talk to him, you're like, man, there's a reason why you're successful. And that's the same thing with all the people we've talked about. You don't talk to I didn't talk to any of those guys and think, how does this guy kill deer?
Right.
How is this guy successful? Well, I didn't talk to any of these guys and wonder that. And it was no different with Rick. Now, Rick is a New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to do my best New York accent.
You can't, man.
I can't do it well.
You're sitting here in a hat with Southern ground and a beard. You know, you can't. It just can't happen.
It's true. But he talked about some really, really good things, and I want to start off with talking about the number one thing that he...
I think I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, you probably do, because it took me off guard, and I think you can probably tell it from the episode, but when I said, when you decided to start hunting mature bucks, Rick, I said, what was the thing that just helped you more than anything? What got you there? What do you think? Because he does, man. The guy kills big deer all the time. And he said, shed hunting. And I was like, what? Really? I mean, and it was so quick. He said it so quickly. And I was like, okay, man, you just got to explain this to me, because I don't feel like that's like that important. Obviously, there's intel that you can use. And he's like, man, I just take when I find a shed somewhere, when I find a shed somewhere. And he's like, I basically just look at that area. And I just dissect the whole area. From that point where I find that shed, I just dissect that whole area. And I try to figure out, okay, if the buck sheds his horns here, where's he bedded at? Is he bedded over here? He's bedded over there, whatever. And it really, what it does for him, and I could be wrong about this, but I might, that, I mean, this is, it would kind of make sense to me. What it does more than anything is it just gets him on the right track.
Right.
Right. It just gets him started looking at the area.
Right.
He knows there's a buck there. Just go look at the, go look at where, what, you know, what's around. Try to find those food sources or bedding areas or main trails or pinch points or anything where you can do that. And one of the things that he said was, when I said, hey, so how often do you kill the buck that you have found his sheds? And he said, I would say that's pretty rare. And I don't know why. I just keep thinking of this in the New York accent. He's like, I'd say that's pretty rare. I've killed maybe six, half a dozen. And I'm like, first off, for me, I'm like, that's not bad. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like it's working for you.
Yeah.
But he said, you know, more than anything, what it does is it just puts me in the right spot, puts me in the areas where there's going to be other mature bucks. He said, you know, if I find a buck, a shed, and that deer dies, well, another mature buck's going to come right in into the spot. It's not going to, you know, affect too much. He said, but I mean, and the proof's really in the pudding for Rick. Since I have been following him, most of the stuff that he posts is doe killing does, because he kills the bucks like right off the bat.
Yeah.
Opening day kills giant deer. And I mean, he's tagged out so fast.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I'm really going to enjoy watching his Instagram feed for the next 3 days before he's tagged out, you know, and then he gets to doe hunting and posting videos. This is the other cool thing that he does is he's always posting videos of, big bucks going underneath his tree because he's already tagged out. He can't shoot them, so he just videos them. Big deer. I mean, the guy could tag out six times a year.
Yeah.
And so I say all that to say, like, there's really two things that are involved in this. It's the importance of scouting and what he said, shed hunting. And I think shed hunting and scouting could be
one
for
same.
Us to be able to apply this to our situation. They would be the same. You're going to find certain pieces of buck sign that are going to be crucial in breaking down an area.
Yeah.
Right. And if you're not finding that at all, then probably don't waste your time in that area. That's not to say that, you know, it won't produce or it could never produce a buck. But I want to go to the area where I'm finding the most sign, the most, if anything, just to build my confidence in the area. So that I will hunt it. And so, like, for that, you know, a big giant track or an old rub or a scrape or something like that could be used in the same situation as a shed.
Yeah.
Because all that is doing for me is it's telling me, okay, there's bucks somewhere here.
Yeah.
They're somewhere around here.
Yeah.
I don't know where they're at, but I can really start looking deep into this area and trying to figure out if there's a scrape here, why is this scrape here?
Right.
And start just kind of backtracking or giving possible, you know, points that could be valuable information for doing that. And so that's what it did for me. It just further instilled the value of scouting and getting out in the woods before the season starts. And, that's kind of what I thought.
Yeah. I think my big takeaway was the breakdown of the end season. Like he basically had early season, pre-rut, rut, and then late season and how he broke it down. And Ted, I would be interested to hear from you because it sounds like all the guys that we've had have also had a system of how they go about their deer season of what it looks like. And I know for you, you have a system of what your saddle is, getting up, getting down, and different things like that. But Rick broke down his quarters. That's what he called them, was quarters. And like what he did in early season. And I know we don't have too much time, but maybe, Ted, just take us through, like, what do you look at the deer season as a whole, or do you kind of break it down into smaller increments to be able to attack it better?
So that's a great question, you know, because everybody, I agree, you know, has everybody that's successful at something has some sort of systematic approach to it. And I would say for me, I definitely don't look at it as a whole. In fact, I wouldn't even look at it in quarters. I typically don't segment that way. You know, I don't, I'm not the type of person that just like, lives by, you know, cut and dry, norms or standards, you know.
Right.
I look at a hunting season as a constant evolution. You know, it's a constant change every day. You know, in the early season, you're getting closer to the late early season.
Right.
And then, you know, as late early season, wanes, you get closer to the pre-rut, you know, I mean, so I think there's different phases. But even within the late early season, for example, if a cold front comes through and gets a nice, nasty, rainy day, then I think that you're going to, you know, that particular day, I would tailor my approach or, you know, my strategy more towards a late season slash pre-rut hunt, you know.
Right.
Whereas, you know, if I was going out that day and it was going to be 80 degrees and sunny, and it was early October, then I would just, you know, focus mainly on a late preseason strategy, you know. So I think it, for me personally anyway, it's not cut and dry. It's going to be constantly evolving and changing.
Right.
That's good.
But I, you know, I do like how Rick has, you know, he's got his system. That works for him, obviously. So, you know, I mean, again, you know, he's got a systematic approach that works for him. And just like his archery, you know, I see that he is he's big into shooting and he's big into taking his kids shooting and everything. And, you know, again, it's an underlying theme of a systematic approach.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that does bring me to another part of Rick's episode that was really good to me. And it was the same as, you know, what we've talked about on all these people. Rick is constantly putting people on big deer. Like, he's constantly taking people. It's not just his kids. Now, he does do that. He does do that. But he's putting other people. You know, there's a guy who's actually a pastor at Rick's church. His name's Benjamin Murray. And I had no idea that they went to the same church or anything. Right. But me and Ben got to talking at the on Facebook the other day, and I was like, dude, I had no idea. He was like, man, he's like, I blow up that guy's phone. He said he's so generous with information about deer hunting and how he does it and things like that. Awesome, and I was like, man, that's just a really cool thing to have people like that out there that are just such a wealth of knowledge and they're generous with it.
Yeah.
And, again, that's everybody that's been on this,
everybody on this thing.
And they've been so generous to be able to come on the show and talk to us and share stories, share tactics, share their passion with all of us. And man, I've really enjoyed this series.
Yeah. It's been good, man.
It's been very good.
It's been really, really good.
And it's been so neat, you know, for me to hear from other people, you know, listeners who are like, man, that I've listened to this episode 5 times or I've listened to this episode 2 or 3 times. It's just been really cool. And another thing too, that was really neat is that we, you know, we had some technical difficulties from when me and you recorded. We were supposed to record with Rick, and he had to work late, and we just never could make it. I never could make that episode with Rick work, and then finally we did, and it was worth every minute of it. So, yeah, you got any last words on it?
No, man. Ted, thanks so much, brother, for coming on, and it was great talking to you. It was awesome hearing from a third party, you know, a third opinion that's not down in it. And so it was good stuff, man. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys. I really enjoyed it. You know, all of the podcasts that you do are great, Parker, but you know, I really enjoyed that Local Legend series, and it was really fun to get on the cast with you and review, you know, kind of all of our takeaways, because, you know, we all take away something a little bit different. We all bring our own experiences to what we take away from that. And, you know, as hunters, we can always learn from somebody else. So hopefully all the listeners were able to get something out of this. I know I did. And, yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Man, again, that was such a fun time with Drew Robbins and Ted Bright. Thank you guys so much for coming on the show and breaking these things down. I'm super excited about you guys hearing this. And I want to know what you guys thought about the Local Legend series. I had a blast personally getting to be a part of it and getting to put it out there for everybody to listen to, everybody to soak in. Man, so much good information, whether it's, you know, just the drive to be somebody like what Warren Womack is, and to be somebody that is not, I guess, distorted the view of what deer hunting is supposed to be. He is a man who has truly established the status of being legendary. And you got guys like Jamie McKay, who is a little more tactics driven, and so much good information in that episode with Jamie McKay. And then you got Peter Updike, who is just absolutely passionate about public land and getting public land out there and letting people be a part of it and experience it and supporting it. Man, that is somebody that I want to be like one day. And then you've got guys like Rick Kiley, who can just flat out kill big deer year in and year out. Just one of those guys that you need to be following from here on out, because you know that he's going to be dropping some serious bone every single year in Southern New York. So much good information, guys. Thank you for being a part of it and for supporting it. And to our guests, the guys I just mentioned, man, thank you so much for bringing such a solid series and being able to help us put it all together. It was a blast. Like I said, I really enjoyed it. And if you're listening to this and you listen to the whole series, let me know that you liked it. And we will do this again next year. I am almost convinced that we needed to do it again no matter what. But, man, if you guys can give me some feedback, that would be incredible. I would love to do this thing again. And if you have some guests in mind that you would like to have come on the show for the Local Legend series, I would love to talk to them, love to know about it. So send me a message. Go ahead and like the Facebook page. That's Southern Ground Hunting on Facebook. We just hit 2,000 likes, and that's pretty much organic likes, and I'm super excited about that. We have really grown a lot probably in the last 6 months, to six to seven, 8 months, something like that. It's really started to pick up a lot. Send me a message on there. Let me know you like the series. You can also send me a DM on Instagram. That's at Southern Ground Hunting. Go ahead and follow that page too. And I post a lot of content on there daily, videos, pictures, just things that are going on and stuff like that. Like I said, guys, 19 days, and we are going to be pumping out some serious content on the YouTube channel. I'm already doing it just about as weekly as I can do it, and just doing some different off-season things, DIY projects and things like that on the YouTube channel. But starting in 19 days, it will be hunting content from the beginning of September all the way to the end of February. That's going to be mainly what it's going to be, is just watching different people deer hunt. It's going to be me. It's going to be some of my buddies that are in Kentucky. If I go with some of my friends in other states that I'm going to be in this year, obviously my dad's going to be a huge part of that, because we always make it a point to hunt together. So there's going to be a lot of great content that's on the Sportsman's Nation YouTube channel. It would mean the world to me if you would go and subscribe to the YouTube channel if you have not. But yeah, 19 days, and we're going to be getting after it. I'm super excited. If you don't already know, this podcast was bi-weekly for the first, I guess, year and a half. And now, starting last week, we are going to be weekly. I'm sure you can hear my phone ringing right now. I'm sorry about that, everybody. Adam Cruz is texting me right now while I'm trying to do this recording. He says this: what if I told you that your property was infested, I mean infested, with rattlesnakes? Would that bother you? I believe that would bother me, Adam Cruz. Let me know, guys, listeners, what would you do if you were told that your property was infested with rattlesnakes? Would that bother you? That would probably bother me pretty bad. Neither here nor there. Guys, thank you so much for listening to this episode and putting up with my bullcrap. Literally just sitting here bullcrapping, guys. I'm just thinking of the first thing that comes to my mind, and I'm not a big note taker. I don't have any notes that I'm going by, just kind of bullcrapping with you. Hope you guys enjoy it each and every week. Looking forward to bringing a whole lot more content coming to you this year. Super excited that you guys are listening. Thank you so much again guys, if you're going to be in the woods, make sure that you remember that God gave you dominion over the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, and the beasts of the earth. So go out and exercise that dominion. We'll talk to you next time.